The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney, and we've got Don McIlvaney in the studio with us today. Don, you're here. You've come back from all your travels. I think one of the things that we're really wanting to hear from you is this. Democracy in the Middle East? Is it real?
You've got to be joking. Whoever said democracy in the Middle East was real. Oh, President Obama did. There's never been democracy in the Middle East, not in all of history, maybe except with the exception of Israel, and we would say that probably will continue to be the case. What is being told us is about how we're going to change the world for democracy in the Middle East by our leaders is not realistic. It's not going to happen. And indeed, it's an excuse for other agenda that I think is probably underway.
Well, let's talk about that, because there's obviously a significant backstory. You know, not only have we seen a shift in the balance of power, but I'm not sure that many, whether it's your news media viewers today, are aware of what actually is happening in the Middle East. What they're being told is that it's all positive and it's all for democracy. Maybe you could just give us some of the backstory and look at foreign policy disasters that we've had in the past, whether it was related to Batista, Somoza, the Shah. I mean, this is not the first out of the bag for us.
Well, David, the political left, I think, certainly in the State Department and elsewhere in our government, has supported leftist groups or actually fundamentalist Muslim groups coming to power going back for 35, 40 years or longer. In fact, going all the way back to almost the end of World War II. We saw this strange thing where in 1958, 59, we had the State Department pull the rug on Batista and help place one Fidel Castro into power. Now, he was a communist, and we wonder why they did that, but that wasn't the only thing. We saw that same State Department pull all the support away from Chiang Kai-shek a little bit earlier in 1949 in the middle of the Chinese Civil War and basically enable the Chinese communists to come to power. That was 1949, and 59, the Castro thing. Then I guess you go on to 1979, where Jimmy Carter pulled the rug out from under the Shah of Iran and actually supported, the U.S. government supported the rise of Khomeini to power, fundamentalist Muslims. Not the first or the last time, maybe the first, but not the last time that we've supported fundamentalist Muslims. We also pulled the rug out from under Somoza and helped the Sandinistas to come to power about the same time. We also pulled the rug out from under Ian Smith and the Free Peoples of Rhodesia, now known as Zimbabwe, and our government helped place Robert Mugabe into power. I was there. I saw it happen. You go on and on and on, where the people in our State Department or government have been supporting our enemies and bringing people to power who do not believe in the United States. We supported Arafat and the PLO, and Arafat was very clearly a Soviet asset, had been for many, many years. Now we're, the leftists in our State Department are sympathetic to the Hezbollah in Lebanon and to the radicals down in Gaza. And so why do we see these people supporting people who are totally against American interest, against Western interests? And the answer, David, is that there has been, over the last 25 to 30 years, but especially in recent years, there's been a merger between the interests of the far political left, call them communists, call them Marxists, call them ultra-socialists, of the far political left in Europe, England, and America, and radical Islam. Now, I know many Islamics, I have Muslim friends, but there is also the brand of Islam that is the radical fundamentalist, certainly personified today by the rulers in Iran. And there's been a merger between the common interest. They've found common ground, if you will, between the far political left and the radical fundamentalist. All of this is germane to what's happening in the Middle East today, David.
Well, Don, as I look at this, it seems like there is a calculus involved, but whether it's a political calculus or not, I would read it as simply bad math. I mean, it doesn't seem to be well put together. It doesn't seem to be well thought out. It seems at every opportunity we're doing the wrong thing at the wrong time. Maybe that's just from a particular vantage point. Is there actually an intended outcome here?
Well, when you see people making the same kind of mistakes over and over and over consistently, and they never make a mistake in our favor, you know, it does make me wonder. Let's go back to the case of the Shah of Iran. There is an incredible book which is now out of print, but if you could get hold of it through Amazon or what have you, get hold of a book called The Shah's Story. The Shah's Story was the autobiography of the Shah of Iran, written several years after he was overthrown by the Carter administration and they helped place Khomeini into power. And in this book, he gives a strategy, if you will, the pattern of how the American government has undermined its friends and helped put its enemies into power. And they've supported in the years before these popular revolts, like we've just seen in Egypt and Tunisia, and what we're seeing now in Libya, Yemen, Syria, Bahrain, and God forbid, one's coming, we are afraid, in Saudi Arabia. And in each instance, he points out in his book that the U.S. government steps in and people in the State Department, sometimes the CIA, and they support these revolutionaries, these rebels behind the scenes. And this is exactly what the Daily Telegraph reported about a month or so ago, that for 3 years, the U.S. government has been supporting the revolutionaries in Egypt to overthrow a person who was supposedly our ally. We gave him billions and billions of dollars of military aid, and yet, as the Daily Telegraph reported, we were supporting the revolutionaries. Well, if you look close at the revolutionaries in Egypt, you will find they're heavily backed by Iran, by the Muslim Brotherhood, and you can go the same thing in Libya. In Libya, the same thing. In fact, in each one of these popular revolts where we are now siding with the rebels, we're finding that there is backing from Iran, fundamentalist Iran. This is why Saudi Arabia is so angry at the United States right now that they're going over and trying to cut all kinds of deals with China, because they realize the United States may betray them just as we helped betray Mubarak, just as we betrayed the Shah of Iran and so forth. And so it's just really strange how we're supporting people who are totally against American interests, against the West. They will destroy us, destroy Israel if they can. What is this? What's going on? There is a certain consistency in our foreign policy, and it's always against U.S. interests.
Don, what would you make of Hillary Clinton's unprecedented move just a month and a half, 2 months ago, of bringing all of our U.S. ambassadors back to Washington for closed-door meetings?
Well, clearly she and the powers that be saw the upheaval that we all see now in the Middle East. And so I'm sure that briefings about that coming upheaval were certainly part of it. There probably was more, but they knew a crisis was coming, and I think briefing all other people was probably very much in order. What is a little confusing, though, is how our State Department, intelligence community, and so forth are supporting rebels. Even the mainline press says, we don't know anything about them. Are they good guys or are they bad guys? Well, there's strong evidence that they're bad guys, that the Muslim Brotherhood is behind a lot of these revolts, and Iran is behind a lot of these revolts. So there's a certain inconsistency. We warn our ambassadors the upheaval is coming, and yet we are supporting people who, when they come to power, certainly are not going to bring democracy. Now, let's just dispel the idea that democracy ever has or probably ever will exist in the Middle East, except in Israel. And I think that's very clearly a democracy. But in the rest of the Middle East, good grief, Charlie Brown, we're not supporting people who have ever believed in democracy. It's just not going to happen. So what's our purpose? Are we just supporting our oil interests? Is our bombing of Libya, and as we are sitting here today, there's some talk of U.S. troops actually going into Libya. Don't know if it'll happen or not. By the way, David, I don't understand something. Why did a president who now has us in three wars get a Nobel Peace Prize in the first month or two that he was in office? What don't I understand about that?
Yeah, clearly the committee was misjudging his vast experience in world politics and international relations.
David, let me answer that question for you. There is no good answer. Let me just say this. Think about this, folks who are listening out here to us today. What is the common denominator behind the countries that where the governments are being overthrown and replaced? None of them were fundamentalist Muslim governments. None of them were actively and overtly opposing the U.S., with maybe the exception of Syria. Syria is having its upheaval today, and I guess you would not call them a close ally of the United States. Tunisia was not a threat to the United States. Libya was not a threat to the United States. You know, Libya is a bad guy. Gaddafi is a bad guy. We know that. He tried to kill you and I, David, you know, 21 years ago when we were supposed to be on Pan Am 103. He and his people blew it up, and we, by an act of God, were not on that plane. Okay, so I have no love for Gaddafi, but let me tell you something. After he got bombed by Reagan and a few more times, you know, he basically stopped being a bad guy and just kind of started minding his own business. He was not a threat to us. Mubarak was not a threat to us. He thought he was our ally. The president of Yemen, who was about to be overthrown and who we are now, we supported, and now we're withdrawing support, he was not a threat to us. Saddam Hussein was not a threat to us. There was all the fuss about the weapons of mass destruction that he had. Well, we knew he had weapons of mass destruction. Bush Sr. sold them to him from 1985 to 1990. That's how we knew they were there. But before the bombing ever started, Saddam had moved them out. They moved them to Syria in big Russian troop convoys with the Spetsnaz on that evacuation. Why did we attack Saddam? Well, when we attacked Saddam, who realized, David, that in Saddam's era, that Christians could actually have programs on Easter on national television. I mean, but Saddam was again, like these other leaders, he was more of a secular Muslim. Sure. He was not a radical fundamentalist. And he had this crazy war for almost 10 years with Iran. And, you know, there were over 1 million people died. And it was very, very sad. But he was a buffer to stop the Iranian fundamentalists, who are the new rising superpower in the Middle East and want to take over everything, including Saudi Arabia. He was that buffer, and we removed him. So the people that we have withdrawn support from, and in fact have been helping their opposition, in every case, they're not fundamentalists. They have not been attacking American interests. And now the people who are coming in are fundamentalists and are attacking American interests. What's wrong with that?
So let me just see if I understand kind of the backdrop here, because we've had our monetary policy and the central bankers from around the world following suit, creating a tremendous amount of liquidity that's driving the price of commodities up on a global basis.
And our stock market, by the way.
And so you see people setting themselves on fire in Tunisia and in Egypt. And what started actually as protests related to the rising costs of food then snowballed into something else. I guess what you're describing is an opportunistic move on the part of the Shiite groups sponsored and funded through Iran to drive this energy towards a particular goal, and that particular goal includes Saudi Arabia.
Sure. Yeah, I want to back up and say many, many of the people, the great majority of the people out in the streets demonstrating, they do want freedom. They do want freedom. Well, they want more bread. They want more food, and they want to be able to get it at affordable prices. So, sure, there were a lot of people who hit the streets who just wanted a new regime and a better life. But, of course, the fundamentalists came in and have been taking over this. The radicals have taken it over in each and every one of these countries. Now, what has been the trigger? I mean, this goes back to our monetary policy. The Fed is creating trillions of dollars. We know that, out of thin air. That is creating a global inflation. Okay, this global inflation is driving food prices up. Now, there's other reasons why food prices are going up, because of droughts and famines and floods and so forth. But food prices are going up. They're being exacerbated by our Federal Reserve. Then oil prices are going up, and they're now being exacerbated by the upheaval in the Middle East. And so all of these things are working together. In my recent newsletter, I entitled it, "The World in Turmoil, Surviving in the Perfect Storm." Good grief. I mean, you got the earthquakes and the tsunamis and the potential nuclear meltdown, you know, going on in Japan, which is causing waves in the financial markets. You've got upheaval spreading throughout the Middle East.
By the way, before you moved to the Middle East, what were you doing flying through the Narita Airport just a few weeks ago?
Well, it wasn't the Narita Airport. It was the other airport, and it was in Tokyo. And if I look like I'm glowing here now, it's not because I'm talking so fast and this room is hot. I was only there for 2 hours, and it was because I couldn't change my plane.
How about the Middle East?
There is this perfect storm that's developing all over the world, David. And I know you guys have talked about this in earlier programs. All of these things are hitting at the same time. I'm not saying that our Federal Reserve, by printing trillions of dollars and pushing all prices in the world up, triggered these crises, but they were triggered by food riots. Now they've spread into something that's quite different, because other people have come in and harnessed the energy that was out in the streets. You've got the sovereign debt crisis in Europe with Portugal on the edge now, and that thing is not going away. You've got the potential of just a hyperinflation with our Fed printing money like there's no tomorrow. And, you know, I guess the only good news I can find is gold just hit 1475 and silver just hit $41, $42. And so I guess people who maybe took our advice are doing well from that. But, I mean, we are living in a world of a lot of turbulence, and a lot of conflicts are coming together at one time. I didn't want to get too far away from the Middle East, but let me say this, David. If there's a revolution that breaks out, a Shiite-backed, Iranian-backed revolution breaks out in Saudi Arabia, you'll see $200 a barrel oil, and you'll see it literally overnight. We'll go through 150 and 175 so fast you can't believe it. If the royal family should be overthrown, and they are targeted by the Iranian Shiite fundamentalist government, if they should be overthrown, you could see $250 to $300 a barrel oil. Now, you look at what that does to food prices, global inflation, and a very shaky world financial system. So,
what's interesting is that if the U.S. is not going to be the security backstop, the paid interest, if you will, to be the bodyguard there in Saudi Arabia, and the new arrangement is either between the Chinese or the Russians, maybe the Shiite revolution can't and won't occur. But what you'll find instead of F-16 fighters sitting there on the tarmacs protecting the royal family, what if it's MiGs this time around? Really, what we're talking about, not only in the shift of balance of power, we may see stability in the Middle East, but we somehow get ridden out of the script. And it's just one more theme that we have in terms of the dollar, the U.S. Treasury market, and the U.S. capital markets taking a step down as others move forward. Listen, if there is a crack in the dam, that pressure will find its way through. So that's essentially what we have, the burgeoning dollars being collected in China, the burgeoning interest by Putin and his crowd in Russia. If they can find weakness in our foreign policy, you better well believe they'll take advantage of it.
Well, David, you know, I just came back from Asia, and I spend about 6 months a year out in Asia, and you've heard me saying, I've written in my newsletter many times, the wave of the future is Asia. The baton of greatness, world leadership that we had throughout the last century and Britain had in the century before is now passing to Asia, and in particular to China and secondarily to India. Okay, the U.S., of course, since Bretton Woods in 1944, we were the dominant influential factor that called the shots in the world financial monetary system. Now we're losing that, and that baton is now passing to China. China's openly talking about how they want a gold-backed reserve currency that will be their currency, maybe a basket of currencies first and so forth. So America is losing its influence as the dominant world power in the world financial monetary system, as these people who are out of their minds in our Fed are printing money by the trillions, intentionally destroying the dollar, and everybody in the world sees it. In the Middle East, we're also losing our influence because we've made such a mess of the Middle East, and we started it when we overthrew Saddam Hussein and just opened the floodgates for the fundamentalists to sweep across that part of the world. So we're losing our influence there. So whose influence is filling the power vacuum financially, monetarily, politically, geopolitically, and militarily that America is leaving? Now, militarily, we're still out there because we're going bankrupt as a country. We'll start pulling back in the next couple of years militarily as well. China is going to come in, and they're going to fill the vacuum. China will be the dominant influence in the Middle East over the next 5 or 10 years, no longer the United States. Certainly not Europe. The Europeans, oh my gosh, where do they come off to this thing? We're going to overthrow Gaddafi and start bombing everything in sight. They're going to have their own problems with terrorism as a result of this. He does strike back. He does strike back, and I think you're going to see some upheaval across the Middle East as a result of this. But Europe has lost its influence. Europe, because of the political left that dictates its monetary, financial, economic, and now foreign policy and military policies, same thing in America. Europe and America are losing our influence all over the world, and the Chinese are coming in and filling that vacuum.
Well, what we might disagree about is the rate of decay in terms of the U.S. and how long we maintain reserve currency status. They've got a banking system which rivals ours in terms of largesse, bad loans, et cetera. Looks a lot like where we were in 2006, 2007, on the cusp of financial disaster. But they have become what the U.S. was even by 1925, which was a massive producer of things. We were the world's massive producer of things. They are today the world's massive producer of things. transition.
Including a massive new military machine that within 5 to 10 years will pass our own. I'll tell you what, David, we'll have to agree to disagree on this one, but I will bet you a steak dinner at Ruth Chris in your city of choice anywhere in the world, a Ruth Chris steak dinner, that within 5 to 10 years they will be the dominant financial economic power and that they may have the world reserve currency. They will at least be part of the basket of currencies, which will include gold and the dollar, which I think will emerge in the next 2 or 3 years. But 5 to 10 years out, I think they will be working to supplant that basket of currencies. Will be history as far as the reserve currency. So we'll just put a steak dinner on that. We'll see. And I hope you're right and I'm wrong. I'll pay. Be glad to pay.
If it was 25 years, I'd make the bet clearly and solidly. We'll take the bet anyways. 5 to 10 years, we'll see where we're at. This is going to be an interesting time, certainly one of transition. I mean, we're having to adjust, and I think the man on the street is having to adjust to a new reality. Certainly higher oil prices are a shot across the bow in terms of families putting their heads together and starting to budget differently, whether it is travel, whether it is even something as simple as groceries. But things are going to be costing more and more. The great deflationary impact of importing goods from China and having their currency pegged to ours has been one of the key components that has allowed the inflation generated by the Fed for the last 30 years to go unnoticed. Because while we were earning not what we could have been earning, we still were able to buy these manufactured goods at discount prices because of an undervalued currency. If they do let go of their currency and let it revalue, you're going to see inflation, God forbid, even at Walmart. And that's, I think,
what
people have to adjust to is that what does life look like when you have to live on half? And we're not saying people in America are taking a pay cut. We're just saying that your dollars don't go as far by up to 50%. So what does it look like for Americans to live on half? And a part of that is a realignment in China, as you suggest. A part of that is the greatest input cost into any economy around the world, oil, being at a sustained high level. And frankly, 150 doesn't do it. 150, 200, those are prices that become critical and are destructive. But $90 to $100 a barrel, if we just slip back to those and maintain those levels, those are equally devastating to people who are having a hard time making ends meet and have not seen their income rise with inflation.
Well, David, bringing it back to home, we are seeing the destruction of the middle class. Whether this was planned or just the stupidity of our financial political leaders, it is happening. And the middle class is going broke rapidly as their home values diminish, as their paychecks buy less and less, as their real income, inflation-adjusted income goes down. And you're seeing a whole paradigm shift where America is no longer to be a wealthy country. Our jobs have been shipped by the tens of millions abroad. I called yesterday to finalize an air ticket out to Hawaii, and it was a mileage plus, so it was free. It was really great. And I've talked to this young man, and I said, how is the weather over in Manila? He said, oh, how did you know? No, the weather's really great. So I talked with this young man from the Philippines who was booking my United Airlines ticket. And this is the whole deal. We've shipped all these jobs, tens of millions, out of the United States. So there will not be an economic, an employment recovery. Without an employment recovery, how can we ever get back to a really strong economy? So Americans are going to have to learn to live on less. We're going to have to, in some ways, it'll be good. But I think, you know, I'm reminded in the movie Rocky III when Clubber Lang, who was the big mean guy who was the champion, was about to fight Rocky. The commentator asked him, he said, what is your prediction? What is your prediction, Mr. Lang? And he just looked at him and he said, pain, pain. And that's what's coming. Pain is coming for all of us in this country. And what I'm seeing is in Europe, in the UK, and in much of the world, probably less so in Asia. But pain is coming as a result of this perfect storm of all these things that are converging right now together.
Well, it's our hope that our listeners and our clients alike will keep clear heads and stay informed and make the wisest possible decision in these challenging times.
Well, Don, thanks for joining us today. And, you know, I wanted to mention your April letter, the McIlvaney Intelligence Advisor, was especially good. Is that something that you would offer to the listeners?
Absolutely, Kevin. It's entitled The World in Turmoil, Surviving in the Perfect Storm, and it talks about the Middle East ablaze and the whole sea change in the world balance of power and the potential for problems in the derivatives market and how gold and silver should react in this perfect storm. storm that's developing, and then some practical ideas as to what to do to kind of survive. So we'd love to share this with people. We'd love to send it out for free if you'll call us at 1-800-525-9556. That's 1-800-525-9556. It's 16 pages. If you don't like to think and read, don't order the letter. But if the things we're talking about and they talk about every week are of concern to you, I would strongly encourage you to get this letter in particular, because I think it tries to tie together a lot of the things we've been talking about here today.
Well, and it's at no cost to the listeners. We'll go ahead and send that out for free. We've got some here, so just give us a call. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Don McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or, as we said, give us a call at 800-525-9556. Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.